Chapter 27 Never Forget. Dresden and Trary ran along the back corridor, passing the lava tube, an open tunnel to their left, a wall of iron blocking the passage to their right. They paid it no heed, other than to use it as a guide point in their rush to rejoin the others in the forge. But then they were flying, falling, tumbling, as a great retort rumbled all around them. Dust and stones bursting out from their left, from around the magical wall of stone. Pelted and bounced around, the two crashed in across the way and Trary several steps into the open lava tube.
The beast!
Drizzt breathed, picking himself up from the ground. On he ran, and Trary, his limp noticeably more pronounced, struggling to keep up. Entering the brightly lit forge, Drizzt first noted Brother Afafrenfir leaning on the open mithril door on legs surely wobbly. He called out to the monk, who looked his way and pointed emphatically down the tunnel. Drizzt never slowed, turning in fast and Trary hustling close behind. The two came into the primordial chamber, Drizzt leading and skidding to a stop as he took in the remarkable scene. The webbing, the dead green spider, the altar block, the pile of magma near the ledge, and the companions of the hall, standing together before a pile of collapsed rubble, right at the entrance to the lava tube, Drizzt knew. Caddy Bree leaned heavily on Brunner, looking dazed and weak and covered with dust, and Drizzt ran to her with all speed.
"We found your Dahlia,"
Brunner said to him, nodding to the rubble. Drizzt sucked in his breath. And Trary, who had heard, ran by him to the rubble pile and began hopping all around the broken stones and dust, shoving some aside.
"Dahlia!" he yelled, and he threw a rock at the rubble and spun back on the others. "What did you do?"
Drizzt pulled Caddy Bree closer, expecting in Trary to leap at her, but the woman straightened, stepped away from him and lifted her chin resolutely.
"She was not the elf you once knew," she said confidently. "She was possessed of a demon. She would hear no reason."
And Trary picked up another stone, swung around, and threw it with all his might into the pile. He sat down there, as if his legs had simply collapsed beneath him, staring at the stone.
"We should be leaving,"
Regis remarked.
"Did you find the dwarf?"
Drizzt never stopped looking at Caddy Bree, or at the burn and bruise across her throat. "She is close behind, and with others we freed as well," he answered. "And yes, it is time to go, and with all speed." He took Caddy Bree by the shoulders then, and pushed her past him to the waiting support of Wulfgar. He nodded to his friends, and they started back for the forge.
"We have to go,"
Drizzt said to Intrary a few moments later, moving near to the man and bending low beside him.
"Then go,"
and Trary replied.
"There is nothing here for you,"
and Trary looked up at him. And the assassin's crestfallen expression spoke to Drizzt before Intrary corrected the assertion with,
"There is nothing for me. There is always something." "Go, Drow,"
and Trary said.
"Your place is with your friends.
You will find," Drizzt started to say, but Intrary cut him short.
"Go,"
he said more firmly. And he turned back to the wall of broken stone. Drizzt let his stare linger for a bit longer, but really had nothing more he could say. He rose, patting Intrary on the shoulder, and started away.
"I will never forget that you came for me, Drizzt O'Erden,"
and Trary called after him. And for some reason he didn't quite yet understand, those words filled Drizzt's heart. By the time he got back to the forge, Drizzt found Ambergris and the three freed humans with the others. Caddy Bree had no spells available to help the cursed dwarf, but Regis reached into his magical pouch and produced a potion he thought might be of use, and indeed, before the group of 10 had even started off, Ambergris was already speaking once more, and non-stop as she recounted her adventures to any who would listen.
Gutbuster,
Regis whispered to Dresden Brunner, nodding his chin at the recovering female dwarf.
I figured that it could cut through any sickly venom.
Wah-ha-ha!
Brunner laughed. And Drizzt was glad of his own smile. He was thinking of Dahlia and with a heavy heart, and thinking of Entreri with great sympathy. Ambergris moved over to her dear friend Afafrenfir and placed her thick hand on his forehead as she began her chant, calling upon her god to infuse the battered man with healing warmth and strength. Afafrenfir stood taller almost immediately and nodded his gratitude.
I've some more magic prepared,
the cleric offered.
Use it upon yourself, then,
said Regis, breaking away from Brunner and Drizzt.
I'm not sure how long my potion will hold back the curse of the drow.
Curse of the damned drow,
Brunner muttered beside Drizzt, who nodded.
Don't like seeing him here, elf, the dwarf went on. Yourself accepted, of course.
Of course, Drizzt agreed with a grin. Brunner started to reply, but stopped short, and a curious expression crossed his face. He held up his hand to halt Drizzt's forthcoming question and turned to the great forge. Brunner? Drizzt asked after a long while had passed. The dwarf just standing there, staring. Without a word, Brunner started across the room for the forge. When he got there, he laid his axe, helm, and shield atop the metal tray leading to the closed oven doors. He looked around, ignoring the questions from Drizzt, and found a pole with a hooked tip and a pair of long tongs. The others joined the pair then, Catibri and Wulfgar similarly asking what Brunner might be up to, but still the dwarf ignored them all. He reached along the tray between the blocking walls with the hooked pole and used it to pull open the heavy oven door. Inside, the primal fire burned angrily, and Brunner nodded and smiled. Then he rushed around, collecting the tools he'd need. We haven't the time, Drizzt said to him when he figured it out.
Hold the room,
the dwarf answered, and distantly, his tone brooking no debate.
Brunner! Just ye hold the room, elf,
the dwarf demanded. He looked past Drizzt to the others.
All of ye!
We have injured, Catibri reminded him, and innocents every moment we delay.
The dwarf looked at her soberly.
We have to...
Catibri started to insist, but she stopped short and stared at the opened oven and heard the call of the primordial.
The axe,
she told the dwarf.
And the helm.
Catibri looked to Brunner, her expression suddenly one of excitement. To the horror of the others, she hopped up onto the tray and stepped between the guard walls, where it should have been too hot for any person to venture, and reached down to pick up the dwarf's implements.
Girl!
Brunner said with alarm. Catibri glanced back with a wide smile, holding Brunner's axe. She tossed it into the oven.
Girl! The dwarf cried, and the others too gasped.
And in went the dwarf's shield, which was mostly made of wood like the axe handle, and surely the primordial fires would eat it to nothingness. Catibri held up the helm and inspected it. It was made of metal, one horn sticking out one side, set into a metal holding circlet, and the stub of a horn sticking out the other. Two rubies were set, one above the other in the front. And Catibri focused on these, the others could tell, as she began to softly chant.
Prepare yourself and quickly, she told the dwarf. Your hammer and mithril plating.
Girl?
Listen to them,
Catibri said to him.
To Dumathoin. He knows.
Brunner closed his eyes and fell within himself, and pictured the throne, remembering the sensation, the sounds of the gods. Like Catibri, he began to chant. But while hers was a mixture of songs, the melody of Mialiki and the foreign sounds of the Plain of Fire, his was the dwarven brogue, the song of workers and miners, an ancient song that had once echoed off these very halls in ages lost to the world. Catti Bree kissed the rubies on the helm and tossed it into the oven. She turned to Brunner and motioned to the tongs, and the dwarf handed them to her. She turned and reached in and dragged back the many-notched axe. Its handle was smoking a bit, but seemed amazingly unharmed. Catti Bree picked it up, examining the glowing metal head. She put it down before Brunner, who began sprinkling it with silver flakes, then tap-tapped with a hammer, singing all the while. Next came the shield, and the wood seemed a bit darker, but again unharmed, and the metal band around its edge glowed, and the relief of a foaming mug standard seemed to somehow have more depth to it. Catti Bree considered it for a moment, then laughed and cast an enchantment upon it as she put it beside Brunner's work table. Brunner had just gotten to work on that shield, reinforcing the bands, when the woman pulled forth the glowing helm, and those rubies set in the front sparkled most of all, and indeed, small flames burned clearly within them. The horns seemed untouched, as did the leather inset of the item. Catti Bree didn't put this down beside Brunner's work table. There was no need. She dipped it in the forge's water tray to cool it, hot steam shooting up with an angry hiss. Then, as Brunner continued his song and his work, the woman plopped the helm atop his head. And Brunner's face lit up with profound joy, and he hoisted his axe, and he sang and tossed mithril flakes all around him. The rubies glowed, and Brunner heard their call. He uttered a word that he did not understand, though Catti Bree surely did, and she nodded as the rubies flared with mounting inner fire. The head of Brunner's axe burst into flames. Not flames to eat the weapon, though, but to enhance it, adding the enchantment of flame tongue to an axe that had already known hundreds of battles. Brunner slid his shield over his other arm and extinguished the axe's fires with a thought. "Now we can go, elf," he said, as if coming out of a trance. "Aye, now we can go." Drizzt looked over to Ambergris, who was shaking her head in clear awe of the scene before her. He tapped her on the shoulder and pointed across the way to the huge broken drider and the weapon lying on the ground in front of it. With a squeal, Amber Gristle O'Mall ran across to retrieve her beloved skull-crusher, and when she returned, she looked to Brunner and to the oven pleadingly.
"No, girl," the dwarf said. "Not now. I'm not for knowing what just happened, but 'tweren't no simple bit of smithing."
"It was a gift," Catti Bree said. "To you. A gift of the dwarf gods, a gift from Gontalgrim." She paused and matched intense stares with her dwarf father. "And it was a request."
Brunner nodded.
"Aye, a deal I'm glad to make."
"A request?"
Regis and Wolfgar asked together.
"We've a long road,"
Brunner replied and started away.
"And one that just got longer."
The others followed, Drizzt bringing up the rear of the line. He looked back several times toward the primordial chamber, thinking of Dahlia, thinking of Entreri. Truly, the death of the elf woman stung him. More than he would have expected. Perhaps he had never really loved her. Certainly not as he loved Catti Bree. But he had cared for her, and deeply. She was at peace, he hoped. At long last, perhaps Dahlia had found peace. And Entreri's last words to him rang in his head and in his heart. He wished that the man was leaving with them, out of this place and back to their own place. But Drizzt took heart, confident in this one's skill and resourcefulness, certain that he would see Artemis Entreri again. Epilogue.
"The wondrous things I have witnessed,"
Gromf Beanri heard in his mind, and the thought had been offered with excitement. That alone alerted the Archmage that something tremendous indeed had occurred. For when had he ever known an Illithid to show excitement?
He felt a further communication, a request that he go to Methil with all haste and with the matron mother. Normally, the archmage would have ignored such a request, but the excitement in Methil's thoughts had surely intrigued him. Within a short while, he and Quenthil joined the illithid in the anteroom of the primordial chamber.
"My elemental?"
he asked at once with surprise and alarm.
"Where is the guard?"
"Destroyed,"
Methil replied in his watery voice. The mind flayer's tentacles waved toward the archway and the bridge beyond, motioning them out. The matron mother was no less alarmed and surely more horrified when she crossed through the steam and mist to witness the defilement of the chapel. One jade spider was missing, the other lying inverted and quite destroyed back the other way by the tunnel to the forge. And most of the webs were gone, the floor beneath the remaining strands littered with the crispy bodies of scores of burned spiders.
"What is this sacrilege?"
Matron Mother Quenthil demanded, and Gromph looked to Methil for an explanation.
"The Battle of Gods,"
Gromph answered his sister a moment later, his voice full of incredulity. He lifted his gaze above the altar stone to the missing centerpiece of his sacred chapel.
"The Darthir sacrifice," he mumbled.
Both he and Quenthil looked to the cave-in as Methil telepathically relayed the images of the last moments of the battle. The illithid started for the pile, the other two in tow. He held up one arm to Gromph, who joined hands with the creature. Gromph nodded as Methil silently explained.
"What is it?"
Matron Mother Quenthil demanded. Gromph offered her his hand.
"Come," he bade her.
Quenthil hesitated, looking at him and particularly at that strange mind flayer suspiciously. When Gromph didn't retract his offered hand, though, she took it, and immediately she felt strange, lighter.
"Whatever you do, do not let go,"
Gromph solemnly warned as Methil led the way to the pile and into it. Quenthil did well not to cry out in revulsion and fear, as her less-than-corporeal form slipped through the stones and dirt. Not between them, as a priestess or mage might do with some wraith-form spell, but through them, as if her own corporality and that of the stones had somehow moved into different dimensions. She could feel the stones slipping through her, and it was not a comfortable sensation. When they came into an open area past the pile, the closed chamber was too dark even for drow low-light vision. With a few words and a wave of his hand, Gromph created a muted red light. They were about halfway along the tunnel, the archmage estimated, glancing at his magically created metal wall a bit farther along.
"What is that?"
he heard the matron mother say, and he looked back to see that Methil had collected something in their strange journey.
"The Darthir's staff,"
Gromph said, taking Koza's needle, then handing it to his sister. Methil pointed down at the rubble pile and waggled his tentacles, the emanating psionic magic, pushing a few small stones aside to reveal a foot, delicate and light-skinned, the foot of a Darthir woman.
"She is dead, then,"
the matron mother stated flatly, for clearly Dahlia had been buried under tons of stone. But a moment later, Gromph began to chuckle, and he and his sister watched as Methil became nearly translucent once more, then reached down and grabbed Dahlia's foot, sharing the psionic state with her. Illithids were not physically strong creatures, but Dahlia slid easily out from under the pile. In that moment, she simply did not exist in the same dimension as the crushing stones. Methil left her lying on the ground when he and Dahlia came back fully to their material state, and the Darthir did not stir in the least, and indeed seemed quite dead. But Methil knew better, and he explained it to Gromph and to Quenthil.
"Strange are the powers of these creatures of the mind," Gromph remarked. "Often I am reminded to be glad that Matron Mother Evenel destroyed House Oblodra."
Quenthil could only shake her head and mutter.
"Kinetic barrier?"
Without any understanding of the psionic Dwyamer at all. Come and be quick, Grumph said suddenly. He grabbed Dahlia's hand and held out his other one for Quenthal, who took it, then shuddered in revulsion as she grabbed hold of Methil's offered hand as well. A few moments later they stood by the altar, Dahlia lying atop it, the red veins in the stone seeming to pulse with life.
Stay back, Grumph warned his sister. When she awakens, she must release the held energy of the cave-in, residing now in Methil's offered psionic protection.
Awakens? The matron mother said, at a loss. Release?
Even as she spoke, Dahlia's eyes popped open and she jerked suddenly, her back arching so violently that she was lifted up into the air. As her physical form separated from the altar stone, they could see that she was still connected by a wall of black energy, pulsing with red lines of power rushing into the stone. The primordial chamber shook once more, the altar taking in the force and seeming as if it grew stronger in doing so. Dahlia fell back down hard. She looked at them, but distantly, clearly dazed, and Methil fell over her, his tentacles wriggling up her nose and around her skull as he joined with her once more. The Illithid telepathically shared his understanding and Dahlia's thoughts with Grumph and Quenthal.
Back to the anteroom, Matron Mother Quenthal instructed as she sorted it all out. Let us await the arrival of Matron Xerith.
And indeed, she was smiling as she made that proclamation, and Grumph could only shake his head at how this struggle of the goddesses continued to play out. When they got into the anteroom, Methil still connected to Dahlia, who walked zombie-like, her eyes empty. Grumph created an extra-dimensional mansion that the Baenri nobles and their blessed guest might relax in proper security and comfort to await the arrival of the Zorlarans. All of them, even the two dwarves, breathed a sigh of relief when they came out of the tunnels into the open air of the crags.
The road ain't far, Brunner explained, pointing to the east. She'll get us to Port Last, and from there on to Long Saddle.
Or Puent,
Regis agreed, and the dwarf nodded. The three humans they had rescued cheered at that thought, but Drizzt and Ambergris both turned to Brother Athafrenfir, for the monk had been hinting that he would not follow their road.
Well, speak it clear, then,
Ambergris bade him.
It is time for me to go home, Athafrenfir admitted, to face my brethren, in the hopes that they will forgive me.
"'Was years ago when ye went with Parbid to the Shadowfell,'
Ambergris said.
"'Think they'll even remember ye.'
The monk smiled.
"'Not that long,' he said,
and Ambergris laughed and nodded as she looked at Drizzt. The drow knew her story of how she had been sent to the Shadowfell as an agent of Citadel Adbar as repentance for some indiscretions. Knowing how Amber Grissel O'Mall had walked the gray areas of morality herself, Drizzt was not surprised when she reached up and patted her friend on the shoulder and declared,
"'I'm going with ye!'
Brother Athafrenfir's face brightened immediately, but he shook his head and tried to insist that he could not ask that of her, that it was too far a journey and through dangerous lands.
"'Bah! But who's to speak for ye if not meself? Who knows ye better than any?'
the dwarf said. Athafrenfir stared at her for a moment, then laughed in surrender.
"'I am not so sure that your presence will bolster my case,' he said in a light-hearted tone. "'But I welcome it.'
"'The Monastery of the Yellow Rose?' Drizzt asked.
"'Aye,' said the monk, "'in faraway Damara, in the Bloodstone Lands.'
Regis's ears picked up.
"'Come with us to the road and turn south, then,' he said to the monk. Then turn south through Neverwinter and follow the tradeway to the Borskir Bridge, and inquire of Dorogardo and the Grinning Ponies all along your way. When you find them, tell them you are a friend of mine, of the halfling called Spider. They will see you to Suzale, where you can catch passage to Impelter.
The halfling nodded as he finished, his thoughts spinning back to the far banks of a great sea of fallen stars. To Aglarond. To Donala Topolino and a life he had known, and one whose echoes tapped profoundly at his heavy heart. When they got to the main road,
and Afafren Fear and Ambergris turned to the south. It was all Regis could manage not to go with them. He had a duty here, he reminded himself repeatedly. To Puent, trapped in Wolfgar's broken horn, and to Brunner, determined to return to Mithril Hall. But he would return to the city of Delphuntal, and to his beloved Denala, Regis silently vowed, as he watched the monk and the dwarf walk away to the south, his other companions moving north for Port Last, and with Longsaddle waiting beyond that. They crept back into the complex they had declared as their home to witness the carnage and the defilement of their chapel. For Berylips Orlaren, the shock was complete. The webs had unfolded, and the captive Dahlia was gone, and the room prepared for her mother, Matron Xerath, was buried now under tons of rock. She did not dare set the remaining goblin slaves to dig out that rubble for fear that it would lead to more instability. The images in the forge were no less troubling, beginning with and centering around the broken form of the great Drider. The captive human was gone, even the dead monk had been removed, and those slaves they had not had the time to drag away had also been freed. The priestess cursed herself for not sending an assassin down into that remaining mining section, particularly when she remembered that a dwarf cleric had been among the few down there. And the dead in the forge, many, many dead, were all Zorlaren allies, scores of goblins, a quartet of driders, and more than a dozen Zorlaren drow, with not a single enemy among them. By all accounts, the invaders had gone, and the apostate Doerden had gone, and the complex was back in Berylip's hands. But her mother would not be pleased. According to Berylip's scouts, Matron Xerath was only a day or two away, marching with the rest of the house and a sizable force from Menzo Baron's on that would lead the way to Desabarak's location in the east. The only good news the priestess received came from the north, where Ravel, Sarabel, and Tiago Bayenri approached, so said her scouts. But even in this there were whispers of trouble, rumors about many drow dead, many Zorlaren dead, and even whispers that weapons master Jarth was not among the returning band. It was all too much for Berylip, and she went to her private chambers and tumbled down upon a pile of large pillows, seeking respite. She lay on her back, staring up at the webbing canopy of her bed, noting the designs and the intricate strands and letting them take her thoughts back to the chapel. What might she do to make the place more presentable to Matron Xerath, to mitigate the rage she knew would be directed her way? No, not her way, she decided, for she would blame Ravel for all of this. It would be a tricky proposition, she realized, for by doing so, she would also be implicating Tiago Bayenri, and it was never a good thing to speak ill of a Bayenri. She would reveal Ravel's spying on Gromph. Yes, this tragedy fell squarely on his shoulders. Ravel had found the apostate, so he had believed, and Ravel had taken the soldiers, leaving Q'Zorlaren vulnerable above Berylip's protests. The priestess nodded as her plan unfolded in her thoughts. She would have to take care to absolve Tiago. If she did it correctly, she might even find Tiago on her side in this conflict, as he too tried to deflect blame onto others. They would all try to deflect blame. That was the way of the drow, after all. Berylip knew that she had to do so not only with her mother, but with the Archmage, surely. Gromph had taken a particular interest in this Dahlia creature, and now she was gone. With that thought in mind, Berylip pictured the Darthir in the webbing, only in the strands of her own canopy. Perhaps she could find a replacement among the slaves they had brought back, she thought. Was Gromph done with Dahlia? Were they all? If so, another body up there might suffice, for how would they know the truth of the newer sacrifice? The image above her became clearer and nearer, and Berylip blinked as she realized that it was not an image in her mind's eye, but an actual person up there. For a heartbeat, she thought of Dahlia, and wondered if a handmaiden of Lolth had somehow saved the prisoner and hung her here for Berylip to find. But it was not Dahlia, she realized, as that form broke through the webbing and dropped upon her, as she recognized it as a man and human, and one she knew. Yes, Artemis and Treri made sure that Berylip saw his face and looked into his eyes as he deftly kicked aside her snake-headed scourge before she could awaken the serpents. And he made sure that those eyes were the last thing this witch ever saw before a fine drow sword cut her throat ear to ear. And Treri rolled off the pillows to his feet. "For Dahlia," he whispered. He wiped the sword on the pillows and stripped the fine and valuable robes from the princess and was pleased to find that she wore a king's treasure worth of jewelry. Now he could leave. To Sabarex or Lauren at last came to the mouth of the deep cave and looked out from his mountain perch over the lands of the Silver Marches, over the kingdom of many arrows. He squinted against the glare of the fiery ball in the sky, the infernal sun.
"Why would we deign to wage war in this wretched place?"
Anzarel Beenri asked, moving up beside the Zorlaren mage.
"Were it like this, I would agree,"
was all that to Sabarak would answer, and he chuckled knowingly.
"Set the guards," he instructed the Beenri weapons master. "Protect this place. Protect me at all cost."
Anzarel narrowed his eyes, surprised that a mere Zorlaren would speak to him in such a manner. For a moment he harbored the notion of drawing his sword. But then came a command from behind him, and in a voice he surely knew.
"Do,"
said Gromph. And Anzarel spun around to see the Archmage, along with Tosin Armgo and his half-Darthir daughter. The weapons master bowed and rushed away.
"I thought you had vowed not to witness this,"
the Sabarak dared remark to Gromph. The Archmage shrugged as if it hardly mattered, and indeed, given the prize he and his sister had found and now kept in the extra-dimensional mansion in the anteroom of the primordial chamber of Kuzor Lauren, it did not. Gromph moved back into the shadows, taking the Armgo duo with him, and there they watched as Tesabarak began his long incantation. Heartbeats became an hour, hours became a day, and still he chanted. But Tesabarak did not move, other than his mouth, standing perfectly still as if rooted to the stone beneath his feet, his arms uplifted and stretching forward, just under the lip of the cave's front roof and up toward the sky. The sun rose in the east, and still he chanted, and that infernal ball of discomfort had just reached its zenith, when at last the call of Tesabarak was answered. Black tendrils pulsed up out of the stone and into the Zorlaren wizard's form, and ran up around and within him to his reaching fingers, then shot forth up into the sky. And so it went, hour after hour, the daylight dimming with a roiling gray overcast, shrouding the western sun as it found the horizon. Through the night, Tesabarak chanted, and the tendrils of the Underdark poured forth. And when the sun rose the next morning, it seemed a meager thing, and the land barely brightened, and those surface dwellers of the Silver Marches, orcs and elves, dwarfs and humans alike, all battened their homes, expecting a terrific storm. But no storm came, for these were not rain clouds, surely. Through the day, Tesabarak chanted, and Gromph departed to a call from Methil that Matron Xerath had arrived in Kuzor Lauren. The Archmage had seen enough, after all, and indeed he was humbled by the power he had witnessed. Not the power of Tesabarak, he knew, for that one was merely a conduit, and indeed might not even survive this spellcasting. But the power of the Spider Queen, as she reached into the realm of the arcane, as she tried to claim supremacy. As she stole the daylight of the region called the Silver Marches, preparing the battlefield for her drow minions. The power of the darkening, Gromph understood, and all the world would take note, and all the world would be afraid. Matron Xerath was clearly in a foul mood. Her weapons master was dead, slain in the cold north. Her eldest daughter, the first priestess of her house, of her fledgling city, was dead, murdered in her own bed. More than half the Drider force she had sent here with her children had been slain, and nearly 20 of her house, including priestesses and wizards. Oh, they had a sizable number of dwarf slaves in return, but that hardly mitigated the losses. And the chapel! Matron Xerath had been told that it would be the shining jewel of her precious city, a place of solemn and godlike power that would serve her craftsmen well and please Lady Loth. She looked upon it now, webs hanging in tatters, rubble around the room and collapsed across the way, and with uninvited guests waiting for her. The sight of Matron Mother Quenthal and Gromph standing beside the altar block did not improve Xerath's mood. They were here to judge her, she figured, and to tell her how her children had failed the Spider Queen. Likely, she thought, they were here to absorb Cusor Lauren into House Bayenry's widening web. A third figure was with them, a delicate woman standing atop the altar block in fabulous spidery robes. She had her back to Xerath as the matron approached, her black hair bobbed around her shoulders and shot with streaks of red. Matron Xerath noted, much like the stone. As Xerath neared, the woman, the elf, turned around to look down at her from on high.
Darthir!
Matron Xerath cried incredulously.
Do you not recognize her, Matron Xerath? The matron mother asked. You have heard the name of Dahlia many times, I expect.
Upon the sacred altar stone, Matron Mother, Xerath asked. Are we to sacrifice this wretched creature, then? Pray, let me hold the blade.
Speak with respect to a fellow matron, Matron Xerath Cusor Lauren, the matron mother advised.
And as the words registered, a stupefied Xerath stared at Quenthal. Gromph began to laugh, and that only added to the tension and discord of confused Xerath. Matron Mother Quenthal turned to the Archmage and bade him to explain, to introduce the elf woman standing atop the sacred stone. Gromph stepped over and bowed respectfully to Matron Xerath, then swept his arm back out to Dahlia.
"Behold, Matron Doerden," he explained, "of Daemon and Ashesbirnon, the eighth house of Menzo Berenzon."
This book is over, but the story continues. Keep listening after the credits to hear the beginning of Rise of the King, Companions Codex Book 2, Book 29 in the Legend of Drizzt series free.
This has been an Audible Frontiers production of Night of the Hunter, written by R.A. Salvatore, narrated by Victor Baveen. Producer Mike Jarzik. Copyright 2014 by Wizards of the Coast, LLC. Production copyright 2014 by Audible, Inc.
And now a free preview of Rise of the King, Companions Codex, Book 2, Book 29 in the Legend of Drizzt series.
Chapter 1. Summer of Discontent.
"What are them dogs up to now?" King Braum of Citadel Adbar asked, when the scouts returned with their reports.
"No good, that's for sure as a baby goblin's shiny butt," replied his twin brother and fellow king of Adbar, Harnoth.
The twins looked at each other and nodded grimly. They both understood that this was their first real test as shared kings. They'd had their diplomatic and military squabbles, certainly. A trade negotiation with Citadel Felbar that had almost come to blows between Braum and King Emerus's principal negotiator, Parson Glaive. A land dispute with the Elves of the Moonwood that had become so hostile the leaders of Silvery Moon and Sundabar had ridden north to intervene. Even a few skirmishes with the troublesome rogues of Many Arrows, raiding bands that had included giants and other beasties. But if the scouts were correct in their assessment, then surely the twin kings of Citadel Adbar had yet presided over nothing of this magnitude.
"Hundreds, ye say?"
Braum asked Ragnarok Gutpuncher, a young dwarf but one of considerable scouting experience.
"Many hundreds," Ragnarok replied. "They're flooding Upper Cerberin Vale with the stench of Orkney kings. Pressing the Moonwood already. Been arrows flying out from the boughs and smokes rising into the dark sky." Those last three words rang ominously in the hall, for the implications of the eternal night sky locked over the Silver Marches were hard to ignore.
"They'll be pressing Mithril Hall, to be sure," said Brom.
"We got to get word fast to Emerus and Conorad," his brother agreed.
"Long way to Mithril Hall,"
Brom lamented, and Harnoth couldn't disagree. The three dwarf citadels of Lurwar were located roughly in a line, Adbar southwest to Felbar, then an equal distance southwest from there to Mithril Hall, with most of the journey just south of the forested crescent known as the Glimmerwood. From one citadel to the next was a march of more than 100 miles, at least a 10 days' hike, likely twice that given the broken terrain. The three citadels were also connected underground, through tunnels of the upper Underdark, but even along those routes any march would be long and difficult.
"We got to go," Harnoth reasoned. "We can't be sitting here with our kin facing a fight. And might be that we're the only ones knowing."
"Nah, Conorad's already knowing, I'm thinking," said Brom.
"He's an army of orcs sitting on his north porch. He's knowing."
"But we got to know what he's needing,"
Harnoff said, and Brom nodded.
"I'll take a legion through the tunnels to Felbar, and if we're needed, we'll go on to Mithril Hole then."
"Underdark," Brom noted grimly. "We ain't been down there in years, excepting the underground way to Sunderbar. Best make it a big legion."
"And yourself a lockdown Adbar,"
Harnoff agreed, nodding.
"Aye, she's already done. And might that I'll go out and have a better look, and might just chase them orcs from the Glimmerwood's edge. Next time we're arguing with them elves over some land, we'll not be letting them forget our help."
"Honnards,"
Harnoth said grimly.
"Bah, just orcs,"
Brom retorted, and waved his hand dismissively.
"Might that we'll skin them and use them to build soft roads from Adbar to Felbar and all the way to Mithril Hall."
King Harnoth gave a hearty laugh at that, but he gradually dismissed the absurdity of the claim and allowed himself to picture just such a road.
"Ready to rumble?"
General Dagnabit, daughter and namesake of Dagnabit, granddaughter of the great General Dagna, announced to King Conorad. They stood on a high peak north of Mithril Hall, looking down on the upper Cerberan Vale, the mighty river dull and flat under the dark sky, and the tall evergreens of the moonwood portion of the long Glimmerwood, dark in the northeast.
"Godbusters are itching to hit something, me king!"
cried Bungalow Thump, who led the famed Gutbuster Brigade as Conorad's personal bodyguard. All around the group came a chorus of cheers, but King Conorad was shaking his head with every call for action. He looked at the swarm of orcs on the field far below. Something felt wrong. The orc forces, opposing each other, rolled like swarms of bees, mingling in a great black cloud that turned the veil as dark as the sky above.
"Now, me king," Bungalow Thump pleaded, "the fools are fighting each other. We'll roll them into the dirt by the hundred."
He moved up beside Conorad to continue, but Dagnabit intercepted him and eased him back.
"What are ye thinking?"
the dwarf lass asked.
"What's yourself thinking?"
Conorad asked of his general, who was soon to take command of Mithril Hall's garrison, by all accounts.
"I'm thinking that's been too long since me axe has chopped an orc,"
Dagnabit replied with a sly grin. Conorad managed a nod, but he was far from full agreement with the implications of the general's desire. He couldn't shake the feeling that something here was not as it seemed.
"We got to go soon,"
Bungalow Thump said.
"Long run to the Vale."
King Conorad looked to Dagnabit and then to Bungalow Thump, and the eager expressions coming back at him made him worry that he was being too cautious here. Was he failing as a leader out of his own timidity? Was he seeing what he wanted to see so that he could avoid a risk? Growling at his own weakness, the order to charge down to the Vale almost left his mouth. Almost. But Conorad bit it back and forced himself to focus more clearly on the chaos before him. And in that moment of clarity came his answer.
for the battle in the upper Cerberan Vale, orc against orc, didn't seem to him to be a battle at all.
"Back to the hall," he said,
his voice barely above a whisper, lost as it was in the midst of his gasp.
"Eh?"
asked Bungalow Thump.
"Me king,"
General Dagnabbit added.
"What are you thinking?"
Bungalow Thump demanded.
"I'm thinking that me king's smelling a rat," Dagnabbit answered.
"I asked what yourself was thinking," Conorad said to Dagnabbit. "And now I ask ye again." He pointed down to the swirling morass of tiny orc forms below them. Dagnabbit stepped out on the ledge before Conorad and stared hard at the mingling armies battling far below.
"They got no discipline," she said almost immediately. "Just a mob."
"Aye, seeing the same," said Conorad. Dagnabbit spent a long while looking at the young king of Mithril Hall.
"Well?"
an impatient Bungalow Thump asked. A smile, somewhat resigned perhaps, but also congratulatory, crossed Dagnabbit's face, and she nodded in deference to Conorad, her king, and replied to him and to Bungalow Thump. "Orcs at Dark Arrow Keep fight better in that."
"Eh?"
the Battle Rager asked.
"Aye,"
Conorad agreed.
"They're thinking to lure us out," said Dagnabbit.
"Well, let's oblige 'em, then,"
Bungalow Thump cried, eliciting wild cheers from his gutbuster brigade.
"Nah,"
Conorad said, shaking his head.
"I ain't seeing it."
He turned to Dagnabbit. "Post a line of lookouts, but we're back to the hall, I say."
"Me king!"
Bungalow Thump cried in dismay. Of course, the battle-lusting Thump was blustering and sputtering, and Conorad didn't bother answering, knowing full well that the Gutbusters were, above all else, fiercely loyal. Conorad moved straight for the long stair that would bring him to the lower plateau just above Keeper's Dale, where his army waited, waving his hand for Dagnabbit and the others to follow. From there, they would take secret doors that led to the descending tunnels that would take them back into the fortress of Mithril Hall. It took a long while to descend those 2,000 stairs, and the warning cries from the northeast beat Conorad's group to the bottom.
"Orcs! Orcs!" they heard, with many stairs still before them. "Hundreds! Thousands!"
King Conorad found it hard to breathe. He was not battle-hardened in this leadership role, and had seen little action that involved responsibility for anyone other than himself. But he knew then that he had narrowly avoided a huge error, one that would have left Mithril Hall reeling under the weight of staggering losses.
"Can't be!"
General Dagnabbit cried.
"Vale's too far!"
"A third orc army,"
Conorad replied.
"The swinging door to close us into their box, if we'd have gone out to the fake fight in the Vale."
"Well, a dead third army, then,"
declared Bungalow Thump, and he and his boys began bounding down the steps past Conorad, taking them three at a time despite the obvious peril along the steep stairway. Conorad stopped and grabbed both railings, stretching out his arms and thus bottlenecking those still behind him. His thoughts whirled, imagining the trails back around the mountain to the upper Cerberan Vale, estimating the time for such a march. A forced and fast march that had already almost assuredly begun, he realized.
"No," he shouted to all those around him, particularly aiming his cry at Bungalow Thump and the rambling troop of Gutbusters.
"To the hall, and shut the derned doors, I say!"
"Me king!"
came the predictable cry of disappointment from Thump and his ferocious boys, all in unison.
"Them orcs are coming, all of them,"
Conorad said to Dagnabbit behind him on the stairs.
"Tens of thousands!"
The dwarf lass nodded grimly. He could see that she wanted to disagree with him, that she wanted nothing more than to go out and kill some orcs. But she couldn't. And for a moment he feared that it was simply because she could not bring herself to disagree with him. Like her father and grandfather before her, Dagnabbit was a loyal soldier first and foremost. If we could be done with this bunch and get inside, I'd be telling ye to go to the fight, she said, as if reading his thoughts and wanting to put his concerns to rest. But this group'll hold us down. That's their job, I'm guessing. They'll come on a-roaring, but they'll fade back in the middle of the line, they will. Again and again, just out of reach. Aye, and we'll keep chasing and chopping, and oh, but we'll put more in a few to their deaths, don't ye doubt. And then the other two armies'll fall on us, and we won't ne'er make our halls alive, King Conrad added with a nod. Dagnabbit patted him on the shoulder. Ye done the right call, me king, and twice, she said. More cries rang out in the northwest, warning of approaching orcs. We ain't there yet, said Conrad, and he started down the stair with all speed. As he and the others neared the bottom, with perhaps 100 stairs to go, they got their first glimpse of that third orc force, a black swarm sweeping around the rocky foothills. Wargs, Dagnabbit breathed, for a cavalry legion led the orc charge. Huge orcs on ferocious direwolves. When they came in sight of the dwarf army settled on the plateau, they blew their off-key horns and chanted for Grumsh, and didn't slow in the least, roaring ahead and as eager for a fight as any gutbuster. Conrad thought to yell out for Bungalow Thump, but he realized that he needn't bother. Thump and his boys, too, had seen the orcs approach, and nothing the king might say would have made any difference at that point. The battle was about to be joined, and the Gutbuster Brigade, above all others, knew their place in such a fight. As one, they ran, leaped, and tumbled down the stairs, bouncing onto the plateau and charging ahead. Bungalow Thump cried out to the battle commanders of the garrison, ordering them to fall back, and those commanders readily complied, for they too knew the place of the Gutbusters, a place in the forefront, as the leading warg riders quickly and painfully learned. Cavalry, shock troops, depended on their ferocity and straightforward aggression to scatter lines and terrify enemies out of defensive positions. But for the famed Gutbuster Brigade of Mithril Hall, such a tactic inspired nothing but an even more ferocious response. And with the Gutbuster Brigade fronting the line, the dwarf crossbowmen neither flinched nor retreated, and they got their volley into the air just before the thunderous collision. The warg riders were stopped cold by that wall of quarrels, and then by leaping dwarves in battle-ridged armor. For the battle hammers, the fight had started on a high note indeed. The pounding, spiked fists of gutbusters drew orc grunts and warg yelps, and that cavalry legion had gotten too far out in front of the charging infantry of orcs coming behind. The army of Mithril Hall fell over them and slaughtered them, and cheers and calls for orc blood chased King Conrad down the stairs, and might have chased him all the way out to the battle, but General Dagnabbit was right there behind him, whispering in his ear, and now it was she who urged greater caution. Conrad at last leaped off the stairs to the plateau and ran with all his speed to his garrison commanders, calling out orders for tight ranks. He ran past the back of the formation and shouted for those in the rear to begin their turn immediately for the hall. "Go and get in and get clear of the doors," he commanded. "Clear run to the halls for all." Many disappointed looks came back at him. He would have been disappointed at any other reaction. But the dwarves did not argue with their king. Still cheering their brethren who had locked up with the leading orcs, the ranks at the back of the formation began their swift and orderly retreat. King Conrad pulled up and whirled around. "Get to the door," he ordered Dagnabbit. The dwarf warrior gasped in disbelief. "I need ye there," Conrad told her. "We'll get all stuck shoulder to shoulder, and them that don't get in are to be murdered to death. Ye go and keep em moving. Every one ye get in is one ye're saving." Dagnabbit couldn't hide her disappointment and just shook her head. Conrad leaped into her and grabbed her roughly by the collar. "Ye think any others'll hold the respect at Dagnabbit?" he yelled in her face. "Ye think I can send an errand, dwarf, and them damned doors'll stay cleared, and them that's running away, and what dwarfs wantin' to run away, won't be stopping to look back? I need ye, girl, more in air before." Dagnabbit straightened and composed herself fully. "Aye, me king," she said crisply. But don't ye let yourself stay out there too long and get yourself killed to death. Ye're needin' me, and I'll do me part, but don't ye let yourself forget that Mithril Hall's needing yourself. More now than e'er, if them orcs mean to stay about.
Conrad nodded and turned to go, but Dagnabbit grabbed him by the shoulder and pulled him around.
"Don't ye get yourself killed," she implored him, and she gave him a kiss for luck.
For luck, and for more than that, they both realized to their mutual surprise. Then both ran off in opposite directions, Dagnabbit yelling orders to various dwarves to form guiding lines to the doors, and Conrad calling his battle commanders together. It wasn't until he neared the front of the skirmish that he was able to gain a wider view of the sloping pass that rounded the mountain, and when he saw that, the dwarf king had to force himself to breathe once more. The orc armies out in the upper Cerberan Vale had been large, but this force was larger still, and rumbling down among the swarms of orcs were huge, blue-skinned behemoths, a full legion of frost giants. Any fantasies Conrad might have had of standing their ground washed away in the face of that reality. If he could muster every dwarf of Mithril Hall out onto the field, fully armed and armored for battle, with a full complement of heavy war weapons, ballistae and catapults, and preset in proper formations, they simply could not prevail in this fight, not even if the two orc armies out in the upper Cerberan Vale did not come in to join their kin and kind. Conrad Braunanvil had never seen so many orcs. They blackened the trail and turned the entire side of the mountain into something resembling a writhing, amorphous beast. Many times throughout that day, King Conrad reminded himself to remain calm, to lead with a steady hand. He didn't flinch when one of his battle commanders standing right beside him was crushed by a giant boulder. He suppressed his wail of anguish when Bungalow Thump and a band of gutbusters fell amid a sea of orcs. And he kept them moving, all of them, an orderly procession, one line breaking back and reforming as the next line broke and retreated behind them. With each step of the staggered retreat, fewer dwarves remained alive to take the next step, but for every downed dwarf, several orcs lay writhing and dying. At one dark moment it seemed to Conrad as if all was surely lost, for on came the giants, swatting orcs out before them as they bore down on the hated dwarfs. "Brace and go for the knees, boys!" he cried, and the dwarfs cheered, and then all the louder as a volley of ballista bolts hummed through the air above their heads. Giants staggered, giants fell, and those behind the first line began a hasty retreat. A shocked King Conrad spun around and spotted Dagnabbit immediately. Beautiful and fierce Dagnabbit. Brave and noble and loyal Dagnabbit. The line of dwarves continued into the hall through the doors in swift and orderly fashion, and somehow, even among that great responsibility, Dagnabbit had managed to get a quartet of spear-throwing ballistae out from the halls, and for just such an occasion as this, when the giants came on. Mithril Hall lost 60 brave dwarves that day, with thrice that number crawling back in with grievous wounds, including Bungalow Thump, who had somehow survived that swarm. But they were secure behind their fortified doors now, and the moment of surprise had passed, and hundreds of orcs and a trio of giants lay dead outside that northern door.
"Ye done good?"
Dagnabbit told him, when the leaders of the hall convened in the war room. "Ye done King Brunner proud?" Coming from the daughter of Dagnabbit, the granddaughter of the legendary Dagna, King Conrad knew that to be no small compliment. He took it in stride, though, and knew that his trials were just beginning. A great army of orcs was even then camping upon his doorstep.
We hope you enjoyed this free preview of Rise of the King, Companions Codex Book 2, Book 29 in the Legend of Drizzt series. To keep the story going, get the complete book today.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.